welcome. It's Brent McGinney here, CEO, President of the Missouri Behavioral Health Council, here with one of our first episodes of the Show Me State of Mind podcast. And we've got some awesome guests for you today, but really want to talk to you a little bit first about what we're doing. So this podcast is really about the history of community mental health and mental health in Missouri, and about what we've been up to the past couple of decades here, and some innovation and some cool stuff we're doing. So with that, again, welcome to Show Me State of Mind. Just with me today are two very important people in Missouri mental health, two of the most important people in Missouri mental health. They're friends of mine. They're great people. And it's so exciting to have them here with us. I've got with us today Val Hune, the Department of Mental Health Director, and Nora Bach, the Division of Behavioral Health Director. And welcome to you both, my friends. Good to see you. And thanks for agreeing to do one of these first episodes of the pod.
Glad to be here. Okay. Thanks for including us,
Brent. All right. So I'm going to start with how long we've kind of known each other. So for our listeners, these two I've known for a very long time. First, trying to think, Val, I don't know the year, but I'm going to guess it was like back in around the late 90s. Is that possible? Early 2000s. We first met, and our roles then were, I was a brand new Senate budget analyst, and Val was a newish
OA budget analyst,
and that's when we first met.
Yes.
And then Nora, we met when I came over to the Department of Mental Health back in somewhere in mid 2000s, I think. And you were, what were you doing then, I wonder?
I was with ADA.
Yeah, that back when we had two divisions.
And I think I was doing like clinical director.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was like 20 plus years ago now, which is kind of wild not to think about.
Holy cow. I've known you my entire state
career. Yeah, working state career. That is right. Yeah. The entire start.
My entire 24 years I have.
Well, let's dig in there. Let's start there. So you're now Department of Mental Health Director. So you started at OA.
I started at OA. A DED in the Missouri Women's Council.
No kidding.
Yes. So I had interviewed with OA Budget and Planning, and they basically ended up hiring me about 4 months after that. But
and then you would immediately like, yeah, I'd rather do
that. Yeah, I'd rather do that than that's what I really wanted to do, but I needed a job in my or I was gonna so I'm a farm kid from Southwest Missouri and it was time to leave.
Yeah, time to go have a career.
I needed to get off the tractor. I like the tractor, but I needed to get off of it. So came up here and then I did that, started that in August, and then by November I was at OA Budget.
And then your career from there has had some turns and winds, but generally just keeps moving.
It does.
You've been in various departments.
I have 5 departments under my belt. So Office of Administration, Department of Economic Development, Department of Health and Senior Services, Department of Social Services, and Department of Mental Health.
No, and that, and you did, I mean, remind me though, when you came to DD, were you kind of recruited over there?
I was recruited over there, and it was
I remember this.
It was very interesting because Dr. Park, because I'd been doing the mental health budget for probably 7 years now on the fringes of that. And Dr. Parks and Keith wanted me to come over. And Jess, I mean, they're all like, we want you to apply for this job. We want you to apply for this job. But then Dr. Parks is like, but I'd already accepted the job of social services as the deputy director for Medicaid. And I said, but Dr. Parks, I'm over here. And he was like, I still want you to apply for that job too.
You did both.
I did both.
Kind of.
The second time around during the transition, social services lost a lot of team members.
Yes.
And so I mean, that would have been like what, 2016, I think. I went over to social services for a year and kind of did both jobs. So I became assistant deputy director and
I remember that when you're doing both.
That was not a good idea.
But also though, having that Medicaid background is really important, and the connections, because there's a lot of it is who you know and who you can call and pick up a phone.
I will say that Medicaid background has been really helpful. I understand this, you know, my depth is pretty shallow, but I understand a little bit about managed care contracts. I understand a little, I get to know a little bit about everything when you're in that role. So that does help, yeah. You know, where to at least start. You don't feel like you're starting from nowhere, a blank piece of paper.
Yeah, absolutely. And Nora, your journey to the department came through some provider stuff, as I recall. Yeah. And then you were kind of similar straight line type through your career and marched through the department.
So actually, when I was in college, I interned at what was then Family Mental Health Center. I graduated college and then went to work for that same place, which was now Pathways. And then ultimately that became Compass, but I came to the state in 2001 to be like a surveyor, certification specialist. But yeah, I did CPR back in the day.
And that's what you did for the Pathways.
We did crisis triage. And so I carried the pager for the ACI.
Yes.
And also did the CPR program.
Okay. And was that building over by Metro, the old Kathy Carter building? Or was it in a different space?
No, this was on Stadium Boulevard.
It was on Stadium. Okay. Oh, yeah. And that's where their office is now still.
Dream of
those. Yeah.
I don't know why.
Yeah. And then you started, though, at the certification specialist. And you didn't get a speeding ticket, did you, working for the state?
No.
I don't think you did. I can't remember that story. But, oh, there was a wrecked vehicle. That's what it was. Well, like, I was just curious. I was just trying to remember it. I'm just trying to remember.
Wrecked a vehicle or got a speeding ticket in a state.
Thank you, Val Hume, for saying that. No.
I like to be. The department was organized a little differently back then.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I would go out and survey CPR programs, C-STAR programs, and then even DD, ISLs, and group homes and all those
things. Yeah, and then clinical ADA, and then kind of just kept going.
So moved over because they needed a gambling manager, compulsive gambling manager.
Really?
And it was also halftime clinical review. So back in the day when people still sent us requests for additional dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep, did that. And then I took clinical director position. And then the two divisions decided to get married.
Yes.
And so Tom Rehock exited at that point and left me with the baby.
Yeah.
Which was the new single division. So,
and we've talked to other states about that. I appreciated that call we had, and I think with Illinois, wasn't it, when they were trying to do the same marriage between their divisions. And it was fun thinking back to that, because there was a lot of pain and fear, a lot of fear, I remember, because I was at the department then, and it was just a lot of, how are we going to do it? And I remember doing it mostly for budget cuts, because it was crappy budgets.
Right.
But also, we did that whole thing, and I think came up with like $260,000 of savings. It was almost negligible, but you couldn't do it to cut.
Right.
There was just too much to do. You couldn't do it to save a lot of money, but
you can make an effort of efficiency.
It was some efficiency and
what,
things like
that. I think it's fascinating because that was like, what? I don't even know what year that was.
11, 12.
That's what I thought. And then we just got it like finally married fully in the budget last year. So it
took so
like 11 years.
Dollars not blended. Though.
Right. They're not blended.
But they're together.
At least together. We don't have,
just the slow progression.
And when you're a budget
15
nerd,
years
you're like,
now,
what?
Yeah. 15 years from now, we'll have CCBHC all together, maybe.
Maybe.
And then, look out. You never know. All right. So, Val, you go to cabinet level meetings. So I always think, like, you know, you're there with the governor, and you probably were even at OA some during times, but now you're there with the other cabinet officials. And like, you know, kind of what was that like walking into your first one as Department of Mental Health Director? And could you, any memorable ones that just stick out to you that you're like, that was tense, or like,
that was fun,
or that was fun, or whatever. Yeah,
so
any you could share.
I did both. We would meet with governors.
What can you share?
In the Office of Administration, and then also as the cabinet members. We do a lot of cabinet meetings now, more than any other administration has done, which I'm really grateful for, because you get to develop a really great relationship with all of the different cabinet members. Also, the governor comes to every one of our cabinet meetings. I don't know that he's missed very many. I will tell you, though, this, and usually he's probably not quite right on time, but he's usually there within the first like 3 to 5 minutes.
Uh-huh.
I show up, the one time I show up 1 minute late to the cabinet meeting, and the governor is already in there and he has started talking. So I'm sitting outside the room because you've got security. You're not going to bust in on them, right?
Yeah.
I'm sitting out there in the hallway of the Truman Building, like, oh man. And, you know, he's in there 5, 10, 15 minutes. It varies depending on where we're at in the process. And he walks out and he sees me sitting there and he goes, well, how are you today? And I go, I am so, so sorry. I don't even have a good excuse. I'm just a minute late. He was like, oh, that's okay. You knew what I was going to say anyway. Yeah, it's all right. He was so kind of me. I really was grateful about that with Governor Parson. And then you walk in the room and all the cabinet members are like, oh,
that's good. You missed it.
And he saw it.
Yeah.
But another one, and I won't say which governor's office this was, but when I was in the budget office, we would always go up and talk about budget decisions. And I worked at the budget office predominantly during some very, very hard financial times. And so we were just nothing you brought up there was good news.
No.
There was one year where the consensus revenue estimate was going to actually be fairly decent. And none of us were used to spending money. We were just used to cutting. And so they get the consensus revenue estimate and they're like, okay, so we've got, and I don't know how much more money to spend that we didn't think about. So go get us ideas and bring it back. So we bring it back the ideas.
Rare.
Right. It was like, okay. So we go talk to all the departments, get some really great ideas on things that the governor can consider. And so the governor's got his senior management team in there. We've got the senior folks from budget and planning, and they're going through the items. He was like, well, he goes, I just kind of need to know how everybody feels about this, the governor at the time. So let me know how you feel by raising your hand if you like this. And nobody from budget and planning, we're all just like, no.
Yeah, well, it's not our job.
He was like, no, I want everybody to raise their hands. I'm like, no.
It's not what we do. For real, not what we do.
Not what we do.
Not policy.
But I really need to know how you guys feel about it. And so the director at the time looks at us, well, I guess I can raise my hand. But when I raise my hand, they're going to raise their hands. It's really not going to
happen. This is so weird.
It's like, please stop asking us this.
I don't feel
we are here to help you.
That's right.
We're here to facilitate you making policy decisions. But
and I felt that way in the Senate, too, where you tried to be as neutral as you could, even though you might have felt really strongly one way or the other about something. And that was ingrained in you that you have to work for all 34 senators.
Right.
And whether you agree with them or not, they're a senator.
Right.
And they deserve that respect.
Right.
It's the Senate. It's the seat, not the person.
Right. I mean, it is. Absolutely. And that's where we were. And, you know, we're representing all of the state agencies. And for me, I had a kind of an interesting dynamic. I went from ag to social services. So it was kind of, you know, this little teeny tiny department with such great value for the state. And then these huge departments with great value to the state. Yeah. And
I missed that.
No, I did. Ag's budget was under us. Ag, DNR, conservation.
So, House Bill 6.
House Bill 6.
I did House Bill 6.
You did House Bill 6 too,
I always remember my best kind of cabinet story, because I've never been to one, was Keith on a Friday. Schaefer, when I was at DMH, called us, said, we got to go meet with Governor Nixon. Of course, it was a pay a dollar for dress down day, you know, and so I was dressed down and didn't have any other clothes. I said, Keith, do I have time to go home? He said, no, you don't. We got to go now. And it was one of those where I think the governor wanted to kind of maybe an idea around what mental health something he wanted to do. And so I go over there. I think it was jeans, which was great, and tennis shoes and a kind of crappy shirt or whatever.
Like some music.
And then, of course, you walk in and they're full suits, always full suits. And you just felt like such an idiot. And that's what I learned. Definitely always have some clothes, at least a sports coat and a collar shirt that you could throw on if you had to. Even if you were in jeans, it made it look at least like you weren't a complete slob and idiot.
And my spare in the car, because I didn't realize that this, I thought it could be video.
Yeah.
So that's why I asked you the question.
So for the listeners, they don't know what we're wearing, and we look very professional right now.
Absolutely.
You bet. Okay, so Nora, let's get to you real quick. So we all members of national groups, and I think you've attended the different state directors meetings for quite a while, as I remember, even when you were a clinical director. And I think Mark, as I recall, is really good about bringing senior staff along so that they felt like they were part of it. But as I remember, that group has a lot of turnover amongst the states. Mm-hmm. But Missouri, I think maybe because of its constitutional Department of Mental Health status, kind of seems like it has a very stable representation there. So kind of talk about that group and what it does, because our folks know of National Council quite a bit, but Missouri's been a leader in those groups for a long
Definitely
time.
Definitely with NASADAD. So I told you I came from the Division of Alcohol and Drug Abuse, which is, can't use that word anymore.
No.
So I went to the National Association, which was called NASADAD, National Association of State Alcohol and Drug Agency Directors. That also used to have the abuse word. Been going there for years and years and years.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. And there you would see people drop off. Certainly there were cabinet level positions or just the retirements, but it was a great group. We saw a lot come forward with medications, even the language, but they're great. I just really started going to NASHBID, which is the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, the last 3 years with my starting this role. So been to a couple of those. They talk a lot about our current initiatives. But yes, Missouri always gets mentioned or hailed or asked to present or what have you. So just this Monday,
it was this Monday.
I was in D.C. presented at Nashville Conference. So CCBHO is always on. 988 was a big deal, and Missouri does great in all those areas.
So. Yeah. So Val, I don't know if you're aware of this. I think you've heard this story, but when I first started at the council, I had some really disastrous first meetings where I was with clinical directors trying to pretend like I knew clinical processes, and I just didn't. And I should have just admitted it up front. Like, if you need money, I'll try to get you some money. And I'll talk about some other stuff. But as far as digging into the clinical processes, probably not the smartest idea right out of the gate. But there was a Nora, apparently, just tell our listeners, what was the bet that I think Nora put out an over under on how long I'd last at the council? At it might have been 3 months. I mean, just not even a long bet.
It was 3 months.
It was 3 months she gave me. Just
after your first.
Really? She saw the meeting. It was he's not going to make it. It was terrible. No, it was really bad. I think the text I got from her when I read it later was, you got to stop now. just stop. I mispronounced her name a couple times. I didn't read it right. And then I think I kept saying things I think we were working on the assessment process. And I kept
saying to stop.
I kept saying it should be efficient, streamlined, effective. I've used all those words that are in your budget books all the time, but just don't mean anything. And everybody knew right away, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
You made
that
it.
That's funny. Yeah. I went past.
Fine.
I recovered. After that, I learned. They quickly learned I was not Tim Swinford. I did not know that stuff. And I've had to really learn it, though, as they say.
You have
got to go learn it.
Yeah, I've surpassed my expectations.
Anyway, that was always, had to get the bet on the cat, on the pod. Well, so we talked about, you mentioned Nora, we have had some accomplishments, and I mentioned earlier, perhaps we do have a book about the start of Missouri's mental health system, Made in Missouri. Dr. R wrote that, but it kind of stops at some point back in the 80s and early 90s. And so in the past 25, 30 years, we've done a lot. And I always mention we've got a long way to go. We keep working. It's always a journey, but I think we've had a lot of accomplishments from 988 and ASAM and CCBHC, Healthcare Home, DM3700. I mean, you go back this whole list of things that have happened since then that have been really cool.
We don't stop enough and kind of recognize that.
Yeah, it's been a pretty cool journey in the past however long.
Well, and it's been really great to work together as partners to build off of Disease Management 3700 to Health Home it's been a fun process and an opportunity to learn a lot.
Yeah.
But it was possible because everybody wanted to work together to make something better.
Yeah.
And that's really, and that's across our state in a lot of different areas, but that's really what makes Missouri such role model to other states. Like, how did you get here?
Yeah.
Well, we live in this tiny town, Jefferson City, Missouri. And we all know each other.
We kind of know each other. The state capital's really small.
State capital's really small, and we don't take things personally, and we're always working to make it better. So I think that knowing that we're not going to take it personally, and we're always working to make it better, and we're never like, it's this, and we're not, we don't operate that way.
Yeah, and I think even when it gets tense, or stuff gets whatever... And we, and Nora and I know this, but it's like we still should count our blessings that we're still talking. Like there are a lot of other states don't even do that.
No,
a lot of
barely even talk. So
yeah, they come from adversarial positions.
It's adversarial conversations all the time.
Kathy, Tim did a great job of establishing, you know, that we're collaborators, and you have certainly continued that expectation that we're
partners. Yeah, I remember Tim would come by. He was more back pre-COVID days. He would walk the halls of DMH. I think it was like pre getting security in there.
Before you had to back.
Like, Tim would just walk
around.
Oh, he would. I'd be in the budget office when I was budget director at DMH, and here come Tim just knocking on my door.
Well, he would do it in the Capitol too, because he would just show up at my office in the Capitol, and I was like, "Hi, Tim, how are you today?
Let's
talk about."
And I don't do that as much, but I think, anyway, he was always funny how he would do that. But
he's going to be on here, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure. But with all those accomplishments, any stick out? I know for me, I have a lot that I'm really proud of. I know recently for me, I think 988 and how that seemed like, I just remember sitting there and saying, all right, we have 18 months. We got time, but we hadn't, like, literally to me, no time when you look back at it now. But I think Missouri did an incredible job at 988. That's one of several I know.
I know, but that one, I mean, just especially when you look nationally, and I've gotten to speak at some other states kind of about CCVHO, and I always ask where they're at with 988. And we are so far. I mean, we're using it. It's saving lives because we're using it.
Yeah.
And they're still trying to figure out who's going to answer the phone in some
places. Yeah.
And I'm so grateful for that level of effort and that commitment and just that all in attitude we've had on it.
Yeah.
It's still my goal to break it.
I know. Yeah.
So I'm extremely proud, and this comes from my background of starting at ADA, but making medications for substance use disorder okay was the longest, hardest fight, I think. But we've really done a lot. And they're now doing exceptionally well, I believe, in the treatment of opioid use disorder. But it was really a mind shift. And then this wasn't an initiative per se, but just bringing our providers together, the alcohol and drug providers and the community mental health providers. That's a big thing where everybody was a little tense. And are they going to get our money? Or are we going to get lost in the fray? And I would even, during clinical review, I would be, you know, reviewing somebody's service plan, I'd say, you really need to get them connected with a CPR program. And they didn't know they had one.
Yeah.
So it's the same agency.
Yeah.
And there was that much.
Even within their own agency.
Even within their own walls. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so I'm extremely proud of how this has come together. You have included in your program, you know, C-STAR providers. And I just think that has really strengthened us and made clear that behavioral health is inclusive of substance use and mental health issues, and they're often intertwined, and we need each other and not separate worlds.
Yeah.
We treat the person. So yes, that's still among my most proud accomplishments of being a part of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, CCBHO is huge.
Oh,
and we have reservations.
For sure. Yeah. That was a tough time. Yeah, it was tough.
But there was a lot of intensive work that went into that.
Oh,
and that's where
we
saw relationships, I think, really flourish. And we tapped on everybody.
Well, speaking of, like, you know, MAT, SUD, and how that fit within, I mean, all those issues were big issues and how we worked it within the system. It was a very, very challenging. I remember a story, Nora, you and I went to somewhere out west. And it was a state deal, a state meeting where they did a convening about MAT. And how that's part of the Missouri system. And I remember Nora was on the panel or got a question like, I don't understand. How do you get your providers to do it? And you're like, well, we just made it very clear that that was the expectation. And it was, I mean, it's flippant say it was just that, but it was a lot of hard work. But it was a real cool, that was an amazing, put us on the map, I think, in a way, didn't it?
We established it in the certification requirements.
Yeah. That
this is mm-hmm. what you're going to do.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you hold people accountable, but, you know, you're helping them at the same time and you're giving a lot of technical assistance. And, you know, that was just such a foreign concept in that field. So tremendous education has happened. And now the people who I never thought would advocate for it are among the strongest. Mm-hmm. And so it saves lives. It just saves lives.
Yeah.
And so that's been really satisfying to see come along.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I want to add something here because I think Mark Scherer did a lot of medications.
Yeah,
treatment
yeah he did. Absolutely.
And one of the things that I was in the budget office, I was the assistant budget director at the time, and we'd given the recommendations back to the agencies and medication assisted treatment didn't make it. And he called me and he goes, I got to have you reconsider this. He goes, what do I need to do to get you guys to reconsider this? And I go, if it's so important for you yeah. to call me,
put this on the line,
say, I need you to reconsider. And I mean, you know, over there, you get like not even an inch deep on things.
Mm-hmm.
So he gave us, I'm sure you, Nora, had to crank out a fact sheet for me in like 12 minutes. And I took it into Linda and I'm like, they really, and you know, and the grand scheme of things, it wasn't enough money that was going to change day. And so I took it into her and I'm like, I honestly think they give up something that they've gotten here. This is how important medication assisted treatment is. And I'm pretty sure we got it.
And it was just in. Kind of a, it was, like you said, a foreign
concept. It was just a
concept,
foreign
concept. So
I mean, I guarantee we're like I said, we're an inch deep on some things at that point. And it was so new. And that was a long time ago.
That's right.
That, I mean, more than 10 years ago.
6 or 7.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was such a long time ago, and his advocacy there, you know, like, this guy's putting it all on the line for medication-assisted treatment, so we're going to go ahead and
let's do it.
No, I was glad to be able to help pick up that baton.
Yeah, and remember, it probably was the same thing Kathy Carter had to do with the new meds for the second-generation antipsychotics, and mm-hmm. so, like, she had to go get a pot of money to make sure people could afford those. And so it was a big, and then it's interesting now that how many other systems are including MAT and services that were at the time, people were like, hell no. And now it's become kind of the standard, which is wonderful.
Our learning curve has been difficult at times, but I do like how we have initiatives, but that helps transform something else. So what I'm speaking about is when we were really insistent on medications, and then when the SOAR grants came to town, we were like, I need you to do medication first. And so many CSTAR providers didn't have prescribers. And so they started shifting their model and incorporating this more qualified, and they had medical staff that they had to secure or contract with. Well, that was really expensive. And it was costing them money. They were not. So I think that was one of the impetuses to ASAM, mm-hmm. CSTAR transformation, because you needed a better funding model to support evidence-based practices, which included medication. And so it all balances off each other, but there were some really hard times, and there's amazing providers who operated at a loss.
Yeah.
On that,
just kept
line.
It together kept as it best together. They could. Right?
And yeah, so slowly really. The system is now making it is more conducive to providing those evidence-based practices.
Yeah. And ASAM, that whole transformation project, even that project, holy cow.
That was huge.
That was another huge.
And I think
that's right.
A lot of states had done ASAM, and I'm not biased at all, but we've had folks who, even in your coalition, who are CARF surveyors, and they're like,
they're not doing
it. It's on paper. Yeah.
Right, right.
But we were very insistent that if we're doing it, we're all in.
Yeah.
We're going to actually use it, do it. And I am really confident that our implementation of ASAM looks better than
most
other states.
Yeah, amazing piece of work. So for our listeners, a lot of whom might be part of the community side of things, they know this, but like the state operated side of what you all do takes up a lot of your time, as we probably serve obviously way more people than the state operated side, no question about it. However, the state operated side remains a a significant part of the DMH budget and operation. And you guys have a lot of same kind of challenges with workforce and everything else. But like on the state operated side, there's still, you guys got a ton of issues over there too. So what are you facing, like from a space, from a operation, like I said, workforce, but like what's going on that?
I think the first thing we want to make sure everybody understands is that the state operated side, both for the Division of Developmental Disabilities and the, I mean, we're the end of the line for a lot of people. And so we like to talk to our team members about that. When we get people, this is their last stop sometimes. Mm-hmm. There's nowhere else. Everybody else has said no. Yeah. So we do support some very, very challenging people. And we do it with a phenomenal team. Mark would always say this too. He goes, you want to talk to somebody you think state employees are amazing? Talk to anybody who's got a family member or a loved one in one of our state operated facilities. Mm-hmm. And they will tell you the amazing work that we do there across the state every day. So that's where I really want to start is, you know, we're all very, very, have very important pieces of this, but that's the top of the pyramid. That piece is just so critical. So we struggle every day. We're running hospitals and facilities across HAP centers and individualized supported living and group homes all across the state. And we, you know, when you're talking about workforce and you're talking about, I need to be able to hire a workforce and you need to be able to hire a workforce, but we kind of need to keep them equal mm-hmm. in the system. Mm-hmm. I can't way overpay my folks. And then you don't, you know, so that's always something that's really challenging to balance is that keeping what we can pay the people that do this really, really important work as close to the same as possible. And we still have gaps there that we're working on, some very significant gaps, but we've come a long way there. Yeah. But that's really where I would start. And Nora never thought, it's a new world for you, right?
It's a new world. Yes. I was on the fringes and then got thrown in the deep end.
And then you came in COVID. So we were really deep in the pool.
Yeah.
I mean, but like said, amazing no team doubt. Members. There's been people who have really helped me in that world. But you started out, I think, talking about this, but we've long had a connection between the psychiatric facilities operated by the department through our administrative agent is history.
Yes.
And I know that's in Paul's book, Dr. Harsh, sorry. But it has shifted. So we went through this thing called inpatient redesign, where all the acute beds basically came out of our system. It really pushed forward the community-based efforts at keeping people there. Our system is now more forensic. It's all forensic, except for our kids. But they still have mental health problems. They're still coming back out in the community. And so that, even the churn in our state facilities are impacted by the initiatives that we do in the community. So all the diversion initiatives, we haven't even talked about that.
Yeah.
CBHLs. Oh,
CIT work.
CIT work. I mean, that stuff is amazing in terms of diverting people from jails and hospitals and just building up partnerships. So I am trying to build a better circle. I need community folks to understand what it takes to keep people out of those hospitals, but then when they do come out, what it's going to take to support them. So that's really one of my goals, is to be able to have everybody see their role.
Yeah. I think I kind of see a big strategic lane there for us to improve.
Yeah.
And it's not that we're doing bad. It's just the continuum and how we deal with least restrictive, how we deal with all the issues of transitioning people out into those different things, and how we keep the front door and the back doors and keep it all flowing and working together on it is an area I think that we can really do some good work in.
And Bill made a good point that for many of these folks, this is the end of the line. We are the safety net. And so we have to be able to serve those folks with really complex needs who everyone else has said no to. Mm. And that is the core of how we've been established and our partnerships have established. So it's really doing the hard work. And that makes then the pay challenges mm-hmm. difficult.
Like I said, I consider us a safety net. I consider us, we're there when no one else will say yes. But we are seeing an increasingly complex population of people with mental illness and developmental disability. And it's a national issue. We're seeing a lot of kids coming into our system with an extensive amount of trauma and lots of behavioral challenges. And so when you're trying to build, what does that look like? And it's successful, and trying to figure out how to get it paid for and how to really help people, least restrictive, continuum of care, there when you need to be there, but then out when you need to be out. It's that's really, I think, where we're seeing that state operated system move. Yeah. We have a forensic responsibility to this state, but then we also have a responsibility to try to really get that support continuum mm-hmm. designed even at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And right. successful.
Yeah. And any of those kind of gaps or areas that folks aren't communicating just don't help, and that we can't afford that. So that'll be a fun challenge for us, I think. And I think you brought it up, and I know we're kind of running out of time, but I think what I've found, and it's taken me years to kind of, you get all fired up about something because of a perceived whatever it is, right? And you make a call and it's like, man, there ain't no one out there trying to screw something up or do damage or to cause harm or anything. It's often just someone didn't think to say this to them or to get something out beforehand. And every time I've overreacted, I've always regretted it, where it's like, someone's like, oh no, well, we kind of screwed that up. Sorry about that. Oops. Or we didn't think about it or, you know, whatever. And it's just, you know, everyone's trying really hard to keep this thing moving.
Right.
To keep it improving, because we all take what we do and who we serve that seriously, that we really do try very, very hard. And so we really keep that in mind and give each other, Nora says, give that grace to people.
Well, and just, we don't point fingers here because there doesn't do it again. We can all do that to ourselves because this is a group of Missourians who, I mean, they're ours.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't matter if we meet them when they're 12 or they're 25 or they're 40.
Yeah, that's right.
They're going to need the Department of Mental Health's help. And what we really like to talk about is, you know, while we do have division responsibilities and we do have forensic responsibilities, we have responsibilities to Missourians.
Yes. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think what I always come back to, too, is that we want the same outcomes, and we have to have it be successful.
Yeah.
There is no other choice. If the community is not successful in being able to support initiatives, then it's all going to fail. So I think it's reminding each other that we may have different paths, we have different roles, but we are all shooting for the same goals, and that's least restrictive environment, quality of care for people living in Missouri, all those things.
Yeah. Well, I've kept you too long. We've gone over a little bit, so thanks for staying. But before we leave, the listeners often want to know, or at least I do, but I already know, so never mind. But they don't. So you guys have, it could be the first, it could be the second. We don't know. The producers they're in control of all that. But now, so like, tell the listeners about, like, what are your hobbies? I know you both got great families and you do a lot of fun things with them, but like, what's the dumb stuff you do when you do get to take a little break? Do you watch really crappy reality TV? What do you do? Like, what's a hobby you could share with us?
I'm currently an Uber driver for a 13-year-old and a 15-year-old.
That's right.
So
just to them.
Pretty good at Candy Crush because I'll have some downtime in the car. So I've got that going for me. But mostly I'm an Uber driver.
It's just the teenage boys are just,
Yes. So, I mean, my husband and I have competitions, who can drive to school the most in a day.
For the forgotten pair of whatever.
Whatever. So,
So that's it. There is no time.
I'll remember what that is eventually. But like I said, right now, outside of Candy Crush,
because I now have both drivers. Right. And so, I'm a nerd. I love junking and going to flea markets and antiquing, and I do like to dig in the dirt and do flowers, crap like that. But
do you have like a storage unit for all the stuff, or is this stuff that you can fit into your house?
Oh, it's
so you just continually cycle through the stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cycle good stuff.
All right. Well, great. Well, thanks for letting the listeners know a little bit about you that they might not have known before.
You junk.
And contact Nora. Okay, great. Or she'll find out. She'll point you in the right direction.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for taking some time out of your day to spend with us, and appreciate you hanging out.
It's been fun.
Yes, it has.
All right. See you guys.
Bye.